This is Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The I Am Troy Davis campaign to abolish the death penalty. 2 years ago, the state of Georgia ignored the facts, doubts, and pleas of hundreds of thousands of people and killed Troy Davis. Now, on the anniversary of his execution, we invite you to reflect on Troy Davis and his legacy to abolish the death penalty and dismantle our inhumane system of caging human beings.
So we go from the public advocates race now to listening to the legacy of Troy Davis. Listen now, and it will inspire courage in the heart of those who are willing to use their efforts to save lives and increase the quality of life for all people. Now, the I Am Troy Davis campaign to abolish the death penalty with Kimberly Davis, Troy's sister, Jen Marlowe, author of I Am Troy Davis, Eve Ensler, playwright, Yusuf Salam, one of the Central Park Five exonerees, and Lawrence Hayes, a death row exoneree. And we begin with rapper extraordinaire Rebel Diaz.
What up, Troy? I can't believe you actually did it, man. To tell the truth, they ain't never gonna kill you, man. You live forever in the hearts of those that fought for you. You fought for us, you gave us strength like a true soldier. I feel the pain, I feel the anger, and the race to show it. I hit the streets and spread the word till the world knows it. I'm sorry we ain't saved you. Should have been braver, but at times I feel alone when I'm surrounded by these strangers. 2009, we first spoke after I met Martina. I got the shirt, but since then I haven't really seen her. Been on the road with these raps, just trying to spread a message. But when I think about our talks, they were such a blessing. You was in jail reading your poems on the phone, and all I did was just listen backstage at the show. Then I heard the crazy news about a week ago, that the date had been set and they wanted you to go. 11:08 p.m. September 21st. Never forget, my inner being still hurts. Obama stayed quiet like he did for Oscar Grant. Clarence Thomas, bitch ass, never gave you a chance. See, you was innocent, there was too much doubt. 7 of 9 witnesses wanted their testimony out. They were scared from these threats, serious like cancer. But you know it wasn't true, years later they recanted. I wish I had the answer, what to do next. Gotta do more than tweet, Facebook, and send texts. We need freedom, Uhuru, organized like Zulu. To the pain of injustice, even though I never knew you. What up, Troy? I can't believe they actually did it, man. Tell the truth, they ain't never gonna kill you, man. You live forever in the hearts of those that fought for you. You fought for us, you gave us strength like a true soldier. What up, Troy? I can't believe they actually did it, man. Tell the truth, they ain't never gonna kill you, man. You live forever in the hearts of those that fought for you. You fought for us, you gave us strength like a true soldier.
Song that we did, the majority of the times, we're the ones that get called guilty. And we want to let people know who we really think is guilty, which is the system that lynched Troy Davis. It's an emotional space right now because this is exactly where we met Martina and where we started our work for Troy Davis. So after we finished, we went backstage and Martina had Troy on the phone. And he had heard what we were doing, so she put him on the phone. And he was showing us love and he was like, man, hold up. I got some raps for you, too. You know? And then, you know, it's three of us. We are on the phone trying to hear him on speakerphone. And then he finished his first piece. And we're like, man, bless him so much. Thank you for sharing that. And he was like, man, hold up, I ain't done. He had us on the phone for like 30 minutes sharing his poetry and his lyrics. And that is a moment that I will forever carry in my heart, because it showed us the humanity of Troy Davis. And when it happened, for us, it wasn't like we wanted to do a song, but a producer from England that we worked with sent us a beat, and the instrumental really spoke to us. It was a sample of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruits, and we thought that it was fitting with the sample and with the music for us to share our personal story. So this song is entitled Troy Davis Lives Forever, and much love to you. Thanks for Troy Davis.
It is our collective duty to make sure Troy's death was not in vain. We must do our part to save the world by continuing this fight to abolish the death penalty, state by state and execution by execution. I'm humbled, proud, and honored to introduce Troy's middle sister, Kimberly Davis.
Tomorrow will mark the 2-year anniversary of my brother's execution. It has been a long struggle. You all have stood by us When we first started out, it was the Davis family. It was my sister, Martina, who was persistent in getting my brother's story out. We have so many supporters of Troy's that are here. We are here to celebrate the life and the legacy of Troy. Some of Troy's last words were to his friends and supporters to continue to fight to end the death penalty, and that's what we're going to do. My sister Martina was the voice of Troy, and she always told people that she was her brother's keeper. The day that he was executed, he gave all of us a charge. He said, "Don't cry. Don't hold your head down." He said he wanted to thank us for standing by him, thank us for holding up his name, thank us for fighting for justice, and he wanted us to continue that fight. He said it didn't begin with him, and it was not going to end with him. There are many more Troy Davises that came before him, and there are many more Troy Davises that came after him. For 17 and a half years, they had one warden that when Troy went before the parole board, this warden actually wrote letters to the parole board asking the parole board not to execute Troy. We have a very flawed justice system. We saw that firsthand in the city of Savannah, the state of Georgia. The new warden that came to the prison, Warden Humphreys, first day he came to the prison, he told Troy, he said that your celebrity days are over. I'm going to make your last days on earth a living hell. That warden, they had recreation where they, arts and crafts, crochet different things. Troy used to crochet. Everyone had like a bookmark, which was in the shape of a heart. He did doll babies, pocketbooks, and all kinds of stuff that he crocheted. The warden, he took away the crocheting. After he took away the crocheting, he went to take away the contact visits for the inmates. They had contact visits before Troy was even at that prison for 17 and a half years. And then with the death row inmates, they were able to get snacks out of the vending machines from their family members and friends to heat up, during visitation. The warden stopped with the snacks for the inmates. Then he actually put them on a 23-hour lockdown. They had 1 hour to come out to either use the take a shower, go out on the rec yard, or make a 15-minute phone call to your family members. Through it all, Troy continued to keep his faith in God, and our family still continued to go and visit him every other weekend. For 17 and a half years, we went to Georgia's death row, which was 4 hours from Savannah, Georgia, every Saturday. And then Troy told us, he said that, he wanted us to go on with our life, but we told him he was our life. And if he was in prison serving on death row, we were all in prison serving on death row. But, when the warden put him on the 23-hour lockdown, the day that my brother was executed, Warden Humphreys actually came to Mr. Benjamin Todd Jealous and was bragging. He asked, "Do you know who I am?" And he asked him, he said, "Well, who are you?" And he said it with a smirk on his face that he was actually a police officer on the streets of Savannah in 1989 when Officer Maxwell had gotten killed. The warden actually came to Troy 2 weeks before he had gotten his execution date and told him that he had had another execution date scheduled. Troy called us in a frantic panic. My sister called his attorney. The attorney said that they didn't have an execution date that was scheduled. He said, the warden was just, trying to get an arousement out of you. 2 weeks later, we got notification that Troy did get another execution date. We were grateful that the Supreme Court actually gave us an evidentiary hearing. The evidentiary hearing was actually brought back to the 11th Circuit, which was the same court that actually convicted Troy. We could not have a fair trial in the 11th Circuit. Many of you that were there during the hearing with the 11th Circuit, and you had Judge William Moore on the stand when we had the witnesses that recanted their testimonies coming to testify to tell the truth, we had the Judge William Moore sitting on the stand asleep. Like the case didn't matter to him. District Attorney Spencer Lawton, under his reign of District Attorney, you had three other gentlemen that he actually sentenced to death, that their death sentences were overturned because of prosecutorial misconduct in their cases. The system in Savannah, Georgia was a very flawed system. The system in the state of Georgia was a very flawed system. When we know that something is wrong, we need to stand up for what's right and make our voices heard. We know that the death penalty is wrong. It's okay for us to come and sit here in the church to honor my brother, But to honor him will be to get out and make your voices heard. Get out and speak against the death penalty. We're going to stand together and end the death penalty. Troy's last words were for us to continue to fight to end the death penalty, and that's what we're going to do. Stand up and let your voices be heard, because I am Troy Davis. Thank you.
I'm going to bring up the woman that is co-author of the book, I Am Troy Davis. Jen Marlowe co-authored the book with Martina Carrera Davis. And in the book as well is Troy's own words, Jen Marlowe.
The idea of the book really came from Troy and from Martina over the course of these last 5 years since I first met the Davis family. And I first met them because I saw Martina speak. I had never heard of Troy's case before, and this was the day after Troy had survived his first execution date by about 23 hours. And I heard Martina speaking, and I was like, this woman is a force of nature. And I wanted to learn more about the brother she was so determined to save and whose innocence she believed in so strongly. And I started doing some research, and I came across the Amnesty International report called Where is the Justice for Me?, which laid out all the specifics of Troy's case, the recantations, the botched investigation, the lack of any kind of meaningful physical evidence linking Troy to the murder of the police officer who was killed. And I realized what a travesty of justice it was. And so I wrote a letter to Troy, just a note of solidarity. He wrote back. We began corresponding. I think that's true for so many of us sitting here who were Troy's friends. It started with jotting a card and not realizing that Troy was determined to write back to every person who reached out to him, and that's how he created that web of hundreds and hundreds of close friendships. And when I finally met Martina, which is about a year later, and she mentioned offhand, people keep telling me I should write a book, and I'd really like to, but and she said I'd need someone to work with me on it, and pretty much right away I said, you know, would you like me to be that person, because I would be honored, and that's how we began working on it. The basis of the book is extensive years' worth of interviews with Martina, also with other family members, with Kimberly, with Martina Sunday Jean, with their mother Virginia Davis, who passed away a few months before Troy was executed, and Troy himself. My first visit to him on death row, we devised a way for him to participate in the book through letters that we wrote each other. He would contribute stories and anecdotes, phone conversations. The bulk of the book happened after Troy's execution, most of the work with Martina, because Martina called me a week after Troy's funeral. When she had gotten a letter from Troy, it was postmarked the day of his execution, in which he told her to make sure she finished writing her book. And she called me with that letter still in her lap, and she said, this is now my highest priority. And we dove right in into what was to be the last 2 months of Martina's life. I remember saying, you know, because we were talking about the most painful things, you know, the whole, you know, starting with the, when the U.S. Supreme Court denied Troy's final appeal, which is what paved the way for the execution, Martina and Troy and Kimberly and Ebony and Lester's mother, Virginia, passing 2 weeks after that of a broken heart, not being able to endure a fourth execution date, the whole summer waiting for that execution date to be set, and of course, the ultimate ending. And I said to Martina, don't you want to wait till a little more time has passed? We don't have to dive into the, you know, that deep of the pain yet. We can wait. And Martina, with her usual grit and determination, said, no, let's do it now while the memories are still fresh. And had she not had that courage, again, we would not be sitting here together right now to launch her book and Troy's book and the Davis family story. I'd like to have just a moment where we celebrate and appreciate Martina. We have several passages from the book that we want to share for you. We have a panel of readers that we would like to ask to come up.
The first is Lauren Pave. This is a man who knows all too well what it means to be in the death house. He sat on death row for 2.5 years. Lauren Pave is a warrior. He is a leader for justice. He campaigned for years on behalf of Troy Anthony Davis, but countless other men and women who sit on death row. So I want to introduce Lauren Pave.
Next to Lauren is Eve Ensler, an activist as a Tony Award-winning playwright, as the founder of the global movement to end violence against women and girls worldwide. And it's such a pleasure to be able to bring Eve here today. Lawrence has gone going to read a passage from when Troy was newly on death row. Troy was arrested in 1989. His conviction and death sentence was in 1991. This passage takes place in 1993. So it was one of the first executions on death row that Troy had been forced to endure, and this time it was a friend.
Troy had never intended to make friends on death row, but there was something disarming about Chris Berger. Chris was tall, trim, strong, and gave off a tough demeanor, but he showed warmth and affection to his friends. He sketched beautifully with colored pencils, often sending them to his mother, to whom he was devoted. He was older than Troy by more than 10 years, but there was something vulnerable about him, perhaps stemming from his history of severe childhood abuse. Chris had been only 17 years old when he had participated in the murder of Roger Honeycutt. When his execution date was set for December 7, 1993, he confessed to Troy how frightened he was. Troy saw the guards parading Chris sadistically in front of the other death row inmates on the evening of December 7th before leading him to the execution chamber to strap him into the electric chair. Troy sat in his cell, hunched over on his bed, waiting for the horrifying moment when the lights would flicker, indicating that a high voltage current of electricity was coursing through Chris's body. Every man on death row twitched in silent anger when the flickering began at 9:50 p.m. Troy knelt on the hard floor, gripping the steel frame of his bed tightly, and prayed for his friend. Only later did he learn that Chris Berger's last words had been an apology to everyone he had ever hurt and a plea for forgiveness. One of the guards who had paraded Chris leaned against the bars of Troy's cell. "Hey, Davis," Troy heard the guard. Troy looked up. "Yes. How'd you like to have some fries with that burger?" Troy resolved never to become quite so close to anyone else on death row again.
Eve is going to read a passage from shortly after Martina was diagnosed with stage 4, a very aggressive form of breast cancer. It was in 2001 that she was diagnosed. And when she was diagnosed, her prognosis was 6 months or less. And as many of us gathered here know, Martina outlived her diagnosis by a full decade. But Eve is going to read a passage where it was just a few months in to the 6 months that Martina had given.
It was another bad night of vomiting, retching, and diarrhea. Martina stayed curled up in bed in the morning, listening to the sounds of Mama getting Dejan ready and then everyone leaving the house. In another few weeks, her son would be 7 years old. In another few months, her brother would have spent 10 years on death row. Martina scratched her head, coming away with a clump of hair. She stared at the fistful of hair for a long moment before pushing back the blanket, slowly sitting up in bed and pushing her feet into her slippers. She had a child to raise and a brother to get off death row. It was time to get up. Martina opened the front door. She took one shuffling step and then another, making it as far as the mailbox, against which she leaned for support, feeling the warm Georgia sun beat down on her face. "Tina, you all right?" It was her neighbor from across the street. "I'm all right." She let the sun warm her for a few more minutes. She might be dying, but she wasn't dying today. She made her way back into the house, and without fully realizing what she was doing, she found herself in the bathroom rubbing a generous amount of Nair onto her head. When Dejan came home that afternoon, Martina was waiting for him on the couch, wearing her favorite dress and her head fully wrapped in a colorful scarf with an African motif. As he approached to give her a hug, she pulled off the scarf, unveiling a shiny, bald head. Dejan jumped back for a moment. Then he wrapped his arms around her and squeezed tightly. "It doesn't look bad, Mom. You look really pretty today." She got up the next day and walked a few steps further. "Come on, let's walk down the street." Her neighbor suggested the day after that. Martina took her hand and they slowly made their way to the corner and back. When Trevor picked her up to take her to chemo, Martina was fully made up, wearing jewelry and loud Caribbean colors. "I might have cancer," she told him when he looked at her quizzically, "but cancer doesn't have me." Martina's strength slowly returned, and as her renewed strength lasted, she decided that not only was she not dying today, she wasn't also dying tomorrow. She likely wasn't dying next week or even next month. She could take a deep breath, relax, and live her life without worrying that every moment might be her last. Perhaps her illness was her creator's way of telling her, "I need your attention. There's more that you need to do, and I need you to do it more abundantly." If she wasn't dying today, then she was going to live today.
So now we're transitioning to the second half of our program, where we have a very important question, which is, what do we do now? I'm going to invite a man. His name is Youssef Salam. He's from the Central Park 5 team. Youssef Salam, when he was 15 years old, was convicted of a crime that he didn't commit. And a very, very well-known man went on television and said, "We need to bring back the death penalty in the state of New York so we can execute Youssef and the other four people that were part of the Central Park Five." One of them is here today, and he was 14 years old at the time. Youssef?
Years ago, when I was released from prison, I was released with my mind in the fog. And I used to have this burning question that I would always ask. How could something like this happen to us? I met a comrade named Lee Wingrath, and it was discussing the case with her and understanding the greater issues at hand. I began to really understand, because, you know, I had, like, basically removed a lot of my case from me. I had to go on with my life, and I had to let it go. And I was reminded of this man who called for the reinstatement of the death penalty, specifically for our case. Wanted me and my comrade Raymond Santana, and Corey Wise, Kevin Richardson, Antron McCrae. They wanted us to be hanging from trees in Central Park. And it was this same bloodthirstiness that I began to really connect with in understanding that had this been the 50s, had this been the 40s, I mean, had this been the earlier part of the 60s, they would have broke our doors down, drug us from our homes, and we would have become some of those. They turned them into postcards, and they called them picnics. But it was a picnic of a picture of black and brown folks burnt at the stake with their members cut away from them, and many of them had been hung. I began to really understand how devious this system is that we are fighting. This isn't just about saying, well, you know, there's some people who are criminals, and this is about how the Central Park Five plays a part of this history of injustice that has gone on and that continues to go on if we don't do anything to the infinite of time. This is about us dismantling this system that continues its spike wheels of justice rolling down the hills of which we're climbing. There's a whole bunch of things that need to happen. And many of us get it. I looked around the room as I came in and I said, wow, I'm in a room full of comrades. This dismantling that we're about, this system is rotten to the core. There's no conforming. There's no adjusting. We need to demolish this whole system and begin anew. Because the way that things have been going, I mean, I sit on the board of the campaign to end the death penalty. Losing Troy Davis was hard. I spoke to Troy. I never forget, I was in Chicago, and Martina came up to me and she said, "Troy's on the phone." I felt a little nervous. speaking with him, but I spoke to him. And I had so much hope and so much tremendous, like the feeling was like he's going to be one of those that escapes. And then, of course, we got the word. And it became clear that we're fighting the same system of injustice that put black and brown folks on postcards and sent them out to the rest of the world as if they were having a picnic.
Our job, we have to put an end to the death penalty in every state in this nation that continues to execute in our lifetime. And when I say that, I mean that. Abolish the death penalty in our lifetime. When we abolish the death penalty in every single state in this nation, we will do it screaming, "I am Troy Davis." I want us to close with him, with his words. What we're about to hear is Troy Davis's last words before the state of Georgia decided to inject him with a lethal cocktail and take his life. I want to give you, we want to give you, he wanted to give you hope.
Well, I'd like to address the Fales family. I'd like to let you all know that despite the situation, I know all of you still are convinced I'm the person that killed your father, your son, and your brother. And I am innocent. The incidents that happened that night was not my fault. I did not have a gun that night. I did not shoot your family member. I am so sorry for your loss. I really am, sincerely. All that I can ask is that each of you look deeper into this case so that you really will finally see the truth. I ask to my family and friends that you all continue to pray, that you all continue to forgive, continue to fight this fight for those who are trying to about to take my life. May God have mercy on all of your soul. God bless you all.
In Memoriam, Troy Davis, the I Am Troy Davis campaign. That is his legacy, the abolition of the death penalty. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.